13. Please go on, Dr. Tang.
We're talking about the Home for the Aged and the siting. When that building was put up at the turn of the century, it was directly across from the Homestead Steel Works and some other steel plant over there, the Edgar Thompson. I'm not sure what the name of it was. But it was a very smoky and dirty site. And that really, and when I went out there to visit in the 50s and so on, it was still there. So that did not speak very highly for the people who sighted that, that building. I got involved kind of fine early on there, aside from visiting congregants, in one of their earliest labor elections. They needed somebody to watch the balloting. So, all right, I said I would sit out there. And it needed to be done during various shifts. So in between the shifts, the ballot boxes were kept, were put for safekeeping into the trunk of my car.
This was at the steel plant.
Home for the Aged.
But that's where they voted.
No, this was for the workers at the Home for the
Aged. Oh, I see.
Yes,
okay.
Who wanted to unionize.
I see. Okay.
And so I became the election judge. It was kind of funny.
Talking about making visits.
That's
all right.
It was the Young Men's and Women's Senior Association of Rapid. Where did the position come in? Did it become the Jewish community drop the Young Men's?
Well, of course, it had an older history. It was on the Hill for a while. And there it was, I think, the Anna Hilton Center.
Exactly.
Then there was a Kaufman building that was part of it. And the name Young Men and Young Women's Hebrew Association was fashionable in, I guess, the 20s and 30s as a counterpart to the Young Men and Young Women's Christian Association. When that no longer seemed appropriate, there was no good historic reason for staying with that name, so they decided to change it. The only remnant of that is the Y Music Association. And I'm sure lots of people ask, why?
Well, they're national. You know, they have one in New York.
Well, they're not national. That's the only other one.
Oh, okay.
The 92nd Street Y.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's, but it goes much further than this. It has all kinds of other intellectual programs that is much more experimental. This used to be experimental. We used to have lots of young artists who were unknown. We did have one like that last week, a wonderful German cellist, superb concert. But they have more often taken the safe route and played down to a rather sophisticated audience.
Do you have anything else to say about the development of why? Does that satisfy you? Okay.
Well, the Y, I've followed that through the years, too. There have been some very interesting program directors and leaders. Herman Passamanic was a very energetic. He was a member of this congregation. I got to know him quite well because his son, Stephen, is a rabbi and a professor at the Hebrew College in Los Angeles. He was a very strong leader and a very able leader of the Y, even in his older years. And they had some good programming people. A man by the name of, I'm not sure if it was Rosenblum, I have to... No, this was a man who was also extremely interested in Jewish art. He had, after the war, can't think of his name at the moment, but that would do that, had a wonderful art collection of his own. No, no, it wasn't the collector Rosenblum, but it, the name.
The artist.
No, it wasn't the artist Rosenberg. In any case, this was separate from his work at the Y, but he did some excellent programming. But in his own apartment, if you can call it that, because he lived in the basement of an apartment house surrounded by works of art, which were, and he sold them nationally, and he found them in various places in Europe after the war. And we bought a few things for Temple. Most of them were too expensive. Should have bought the whole lot. By modern standards, it would have been very cheap. But it was an interesting place. He had good general art, Fabergé and other material, plus good Jewish material in a place that was a completely chaotic bachelor's apartment where he had some cats there. If you wandered around, you saw remnants of meal sitting here, there, and yonder.
I can't think of his name.
The visits were always interesting. I cannot think of his name at the moment.
Okay. Going back to visiting, making personal calls, I'm sure throughout your career you made many, many visits to Montefiore Hospital. Have you any thoughts about University of Pittsburgh Medical Center taking over Montefiore?
You know, there were a lot of people who felt sad about losing a Jewish hospital. But I think one has to look at it in the following way, that first of all, it really wasn't a Jewish hospital. It was a Jewish hospital in name. But Jewish physicians by the time it was taken over, were lots of other, almost all the other hospitals too. And so the original function of having a place that where, first of all, Jews could go for treatment and have kosher meals and so on, and secondly, perhaps even more important, Jewish doctors would be allowed to practice, that was no longer a major issue. And in the modern medical setting, a standalone hospital like that really can't make it. Got to combine, and that's happened now to every other hospital in this area too, and to all the other Jewish hospitals around the country. So, in spite of all the uproar at the time and all the unhappiness, looking at it in retrospect, it was a wise decision because it left the Jewish community with the Jewish Healthcare Foundation, which is well funded and has been able to do lots of interesting things, not only for the Jewish community, but for the general community. And if you had tried to do this 10 or 15 years later, when the pressure was on to combine, I don't know that it would have been successful.
But so you feel it was a wise thing?
Yes, I think
to do at that time.
Yeah, I think it was the right thing to do, and the people. Some people took a lot of heat for it, but certainly in retrospect, it was the right thing. And the doctors that I've talked to, who were angry at that, and who look at it now, especially at this point with the healthcare system in turmoil, changing drastically, also feel that, well, it was good to get out of that part.
Still in the neighborhood of Oakland, I notice on your resume that you were a member of the board of WQED from 1968 to 94. You were also awarded their Q Award. That's a very long tenure on such a board. What was your position on that?
I was a board member and occasionally a chair of a committee. But during virtually all of those years, the board was less, we made general policy, but we did not, it was more an advisory board than a running board. These were years until the 90s, really years of expansion. QED expanded from a local broadcasting station, a strong local broadcasting station, to a station that had two channels, a station that had a good music channel as well, and that did a tremendous amount of national production, funded by the local companies. So Gulf Oil was heavily involved, and U.S. Steel, and Alcoa. When those, and a lot of the troubles of QED subsequently were not so much the fault of either the director or the board, in a sense they were our fault, but the inability to look into the future appropriately, because when the companies disappeared, and there one can see that great big companies are capable of making giant mistakes, which cost millions of dollars and thousands of jobs, the funding also disappeared. And there was no good reason for a company that now was in Texas to fund programs at a station in Pittsburgh. The people who were on the board, largely business types, didn't see this either, and didn't see this coming. And so when the downsizing had to begin, it was difficult and drastic, and probably not made quite fast enough. So suddenly in the late 80s, early 90s, the board had to become less of a policymaking, still a policymaking board, but had to pay a great deal of attention to the bottom line. There was still a good bit of hope that things would change, and that funding could be found for the national program, which was really what was costing us so much money. But that proved not to work out. Actually, the people in charge, Kaiser,
Lloyd Kaiser,
yeah, and others. He had a very good staff, production staff in particular. It was superb, with the production facilities in Los Angeles and New York. We're very good, and also very, very careful, but they did not want to cut those things and abandon them, because they're so hard to establish. If you've got a facility, you've got the right staff in place, and you have the capacity to produce good national programs, and a proposal has been turned down, you could simply disband and say, all right, we're not going to try again. Or you could say, well, we'll take a chance, and I know it'll cost us a few $100,000, but I think this is going to, the next time, the answer is going to be yes. But when the answer turned out to be no several times in succession, of course, a deficit began to accumulate.
You know my next question?
No.
Tell us your feelings about the possible, well, the proposal to sell the second channel, QEX, and that would then be available for a funding.
Well, you know, I'm less concerned with who owns the station, if it's going to be sold, than with the question, should it be sold at all? It seems to me that, at this point at least, it's important that we have two stations. We're among the few cities that have two stations. The second station operates almost entirely automatically. In other words, there's very little staff involved. So you're talking mainly about costs, programming costs, and fixed costs. And if the programming on that station, and that can be controlled because you can buy expensive programming or cheaper programming. But it does present a real alternative here. And it is true, people say, well, there are so many things on channel television. They've got 50 channels, I don't know how many you got.
100.
Probably depends on what you want to buy.
With cable.
With cable. We do not have cable at home, but every once in a while I'll go to somebody's house or son's house and flip through the cable. If I'm there babysitting Zach or something like that. And it is amazing that you can flip through 30 channels and not find a single thing that interests you. Go back to channel 13, which is free and public, and 16, and those are good. So saying that it exists on cable is, to a large extent, not so. Now, it's true that in the future, there are technologies that would enable a single channel to present multiple programs. However, that is not yet available. There are, of course, other technologies which would enable one to virtually set up a television station on a computer. But that's also still some years down the road. So it seems to me short-sighted to sell a basic asset to cover a relatively small deficit. We're talking about $10 million. For a city like this, with the wealth that exists here, that's not a big deficit. It should be possible to cover that. The operating costs are in balance, so the deficit is not increasing. And the station is certainly not going to lose in value in 16. So it seems to me, if you have it, hold on to it. I feel the same way with some of the things that the city is doing, or the county. It sounds very tempting to sell an asset like a water company or something like that. Cover your problems. So for 1 year you have breathing space. What do you do after that? Can you sell City Hall? Put up a garage instead? Can move out to an industrial park? With the city government, where it's cheaper. These things are often short-sighted. And I would oppose that. I'm not on the board, but I've...
But if you are on the board, only... But you're coming from the point of view that it's an asset, a fundamental Christian station.
Well...
Do you want to address that? Or fundamental stations in general?
Not really, because if... You know, they if they want to, they can find a station and buy it. And whether they buy this station or another station, that's their prerogative. So we have problems with that. We have freedom of speech. If somebody wishes to try to present a certain philosophy, especially if they're, you know, when people are up front of that.
Well, they've been.
No, but this is not. What bothers me sometimes on television has nothing to do with fundamentalism, are the infomercials that you find on paper. And if you tune into one of those in the middle, you don't realize that it's an infomercial until some time has passed. Well, you usually catch that a little earlier than that because it just doesn't sound right.
Can we we switch gears?
Sure.
Okay. I would like you to tell us about your newest involvement, namely Benefit, Honors and Responsibilities Journal.
Okay. Well, there aren't any honors particularly, but there is some responsibility. What happened is really very simple. The German Jewish community has grown. It is approaching 100,000, and will exceed that probably by next year. These are Jews from Russia, the largest group from what once was Russia, Ukraine, the neighboring republics, from Israel, from Western countries, and people who have gone there from those countries because of the commercial or manufacturing possibilities, and from Russia because Germany has been exceptionally generous in its benefits for individuals fleeing religious persecution, or Jews particularly coming, wanting to settle. That may change, and there are still, I think, 40 or 50,000 Jews in Russia registered to return to Germany, so there's a big pool that's waiting.
When you say return, have they been?
No, sorry, return as well, to go to Germany, none of them. Well, this has meant that the structure of the community has changed, and so have the problems. These individuals are often not easy to assimilate for many different reasons. Partly they expect a great deal from the state, and if the state doesn't, in Germany, the religious community often plays the role of the state, and so the religious community then has to help absorb, help support, and help move off the supporting role when they feel it's appropriate. Many individuals from the East are reluctant to move in that direction. More important for the Jewish community, from the Jewish point of view, is the fact that the status of these individuals is often doubtful. Or even if it isn't doubtful, they can't prove that they're Jewish. Here is, let's say, somebody who the rabbi asks, "Are you Jewish?" He says, "Yes, I'm Jewish. Here's my internal passport that shows that I'm Jewish." "Well, what can you tell me about your mother?" "Nothing." Because in the middle of the war, when I was an infant, I was transported to Siberia. No idea about my mother. Never met her. What does the rabbi say in those instances? I mean, here the rabbi would say, "Okay, what's going on? You're involved in the community." In Germany, the Orthodox rabbis, the current Orthodox rabbis, say, "Well, we have no proof. As far as we're concerned, you're not Jewish." Well, and if this man then says, "Well, what do I have to do to become Jewish?" The current Orthodox rabbis say, "There's nothing we can do for you. We're not converted." And they say exactly the same thing when somebody who is clearly Jewish comes with a non-Jewish wife and says, "In Russia, she could not become Jewish. She wishes to become Jewish now. What can you do for her?" Answer is nothing. Well, why is that? Because after the Second World War, when Jews came to Germany, and hardly any returned, so I'm not talking about the handful that returned, I'm talking about the others, they came from Eastern Europe. They were traditional. They brought traditional rabbis with them. But these traditional rabbis were not fanatics. They were willing to live and let live. generation of rabbis are Israelis who hope to go back to Israel, who are looking and hope that when they get back to Israel, they will be seen in a favorable light by the chief rabbinate, which makes assignments. And so they know that if they start converting people and being open to other changes, or to any changes, the chief rabbinate will send them to a small town in the Negev for the rest of their life. So they are towing the line. Orthodox, if you came to an Orthodox rabbi here, the Orthodox rabbi, as we do also, would warn the convert one of the problems, potential problems, then would ask for a course of study, which would be something different than ours, but paralleling it, and then at the end there would be a ceremony, a trip to the mikveh, circumcision for the man if that was necessary.
Sorry.
So it's perfectly possible, and in fact, the Shulchan Aruch, the statement on conversion, is clear-cut, simple, and direct, and there's no reason to be as negative. That's just part of the current problem. The other is that these individuals need general education. They need a path into Judaism that is makes sense to them, that is modern. And you have a new generation of Jews who grew up in Germany to whom Orthodoxy does not necessarily appeal. So you've got immigrants, and you've got young German Jews who are looking for something else and who have asked these Orthodox rabbis for something else. It's not been forthcoming. So by now there are 20 small reform communities that have formed, grassroots, have simply decided we want something different. The problems that they have faced have been multiple. One is no communal support. As you know, all religious groups are supported financially by the government in Germany. Secondly, ostracism. And third, No professional leadership. There are three Reform rabbis in Germany who are well into their 80s. So they still do occasional something, but certainly are not able to do terribly much.
Where do they come from?
No, they are individuals who left. Military chaplain, others spent some time in Sweden, third of them. There is also one young rabbi in Germany, a woman, who is conservative, but that's to the Orthodox, is bad, maybe a person reform, and a reform rabbi in Switzerland. Conservative rabbi is her name is Weiler. So there's very little leadership. So when I went to a meeting to give some papers last year in Vienna of many of these congregations, a sort of a study session, it was clear that they needed help, and I indicated that I'd be willing to. So they asked me to come and to help with the organization and to help with lots of other things too. But it soon became apparent that if you wanted to do this, that you needed to have some sort of standing in Germany. So the Munich community, a small group of people, 130 people, invited me to become their senior rabbi. So, okay. And this is, of course, you know, there. After all, I have a good pension here, so this is, there's no finances involved in this. voluntary effort. So I agreed to that, and but told them that I did not want to live here and go to Munich on a reasonably regular basis and do for them whatever was possible from a distance or on these visits. So what has happened up to now, I've been there, was there last fall, I'll go again in summer, if possible to go before that. We're going to need another notebook. A lot of work can be done through the internet and through correspondence. So what I'm currently involved with are helping some people convert, helping set up a program for individuals like that, working on some texts. For example, a man who has written a very nice text on Judaism, sort of basic Judaism introduction. It needed some work to it.